This is the PT Pintcast, a podcast that talks about physical therapy over beer, bringing together clinicians, researchers, and forward-thinking PTs in a show that's anything but boring.
Let there be beer!
This is the PT Pintcast with your host, Jimmy McKay.
Well, here we go. The next episode of the PT Pintcast. The greatest conversations happen at happy hour. Welcome to ours. Today, we talk with Brian Finch, PT and CSCS. You can find him on Twitter at Alpine Athlete. He does some elite training and therapy for your Alpine pursuits, exercise, manual therapy, and dry needling pro. He's been working at the Rutland Regional Medical Center in Vermont. And he's the sports medicine moderator at epicski.com. I'm guessing with a Twitter handle like Alpine Athlete, you want to be in the hills as much as possible. Brian, welcome to the Pintcast.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
So Alpine Athlete, and that's kind of what drew us to your Twitter feed and just to some of the stuff that you're putting out there. It's a little bit left to center in terms of orthopedics. So how did you get into Alpine therapy?
I was practicing just north of New York City for a while, and my wife and I are both on the Skier's Edge Masters National Team, so we were spending a lot of time in Vermont anyway, and I ended up, finding a job and being recruited up to Vermont. Moved up here with my wife about 10 years ago, and we've been practicing up here ever since.
Now, is she a PT as well?
She's actually a physician assistant.
So yeah, you guys are both in the medical field, and I don't know if some of the listeners can actually hear, of course. Brian being in Vermont, he's outside rubbing it in my face right now, and you can hear the wind blowing in the background. So thank you very much for that. We appreciate it.
Sorry about that. Have to let that soak in a little bit there.
So now Alpine therapy, I'm guessing it has to do with skiing and snowboarding, climbing, snowshoeing, but what is it?
Well, basically there's a void in the way that we kind of look at athletes. We go ahead and we rehabilitate them, and we've kind of swapped out, functional for effective. We look at people and we say, hey, you can walk down the hallway and, you're not using a cane anymore. And then we send you off. I kind of found that, we weren't really addressing the needs that people had. People don't go from walking with a cane to, wanting to throw their body down the hill at 90 miles an hour. And so this kind of bridges some of the gaps and looks at, just how we can kind of treat them a little bit differently.
So I'm guessing you being in Vermont and doing the Alpine therapy, you're seeing a lot of skier, snowboarder injury, and some of these are going to be pretty severe. And so some of your even younger athletes might be walking with a cane because, like you said, they're going down the hill at 90 miles an hour. That's a pretty big transition.
Yeah, and it's so easy to kind of get yourself in a precarious situation. I mean, these days, I'm a little bit older than you are, I think. So, there used to be a little bit more apprenticeship when you wanted to get into something like climbing or, whether it's, big mountain mountain biking or skiing. These days you can pretty much go to YouTube and order up whatever you want off the internet, and a chairlift ride later, you're at the top of a hill. This sort of looks at, what are the prerequisites for effective movement for, kind of climbing, Alpine skiing, how do we get people back to, real elite level stuff? I work with a lot of runners. They tend to be a little bit more in tune with their body than some of the other athletes. So they tend to come in a little bit more frequently. But, there's a big gap from, you're cleared to go back to exercising and you're successful at what you want to do. We also work with some sponsored athletes where, their livelihood is coming out of how they perform and, what drops next on YouTube for them.
So you kind of had a little bit of an inside edge being a sponsored skier, being on teams. So you knew the mentality, you knew the language, you knew the lingo, and then being a PT, you kind of had that edge. But let's say a PT student right now wants to do something like this. What's a good start? What's a good way to get the foot in the door?
I'm not coming on to be controversial, but, I think I want to help you out with some knowledge. One of the things that I firmly believe in is that, as physical therapists, we're not as good at exercise as we think we are. I think that the athletic trainers really have us beat. I think that some of the personal trainers have us beat. And I would encourage you to kind of look at some of the certifications. I've been certified through the National Strength and Conditioning Association for almost 20 years now. I think they're at the forefront of it. I would really tend to push out beyond kind of the VHI card, mentality, physical therapist, and, start to look at some things that maybe are a little bit fringe. Look at your blood flow restriction training. Look at your dry needling. Look at some of the demands that athletes are putting on themselves, and then see who's really doing the training for that. most of the time it's not physical therapists. It's athletic trainers who've gone on and expanded a little bit, or it's, you know, physical therapists who've kind of gone off the reservation a little bit as well. And then, you know, try and network. Twitter's a great place to do that. And see what the credentials of people who, you know, who are actually taking care of these athletes are. I spent a few years coaching fist level, coaching traveling skiers, and, you know, working with high-level athletes. And, you know, you really see the difference between, you know, if somebody gets 1% faster, they may make that jump from, you know, racing at the NORAM level to racing on the World Cup. And that's 1%. So, you know, how do we squeeze the most out of a performance program, and how do we kind of optimize what we have going, you know, for an athlete?
So being that you go from walking with a cane, or you go from someone who's going to be injured to getting back and being an elite athlete, what is a typical treatment session like as you get closer to back being on the hill? I mean, that's going to be a pretty sweet day if you're out there on the hill with them.
Every once in a while I do get to go out on the hill, but a lot of times it's, you know, it's a lot of communication. It's a lot of coordinating with coaches, physicians. You know, sometimes they've got trainers, or they've got, you know, they've got team captains. So, you know, you may, you know, look, exercise that's good for athletes is exercise that's good for everyone else. We just need to scale. And, you know, one of the things that you see is that you go from doing, you know, sort of a kind of a blandish, you know, 3 sets of 10, maybe doing some high rep stuff to build some neuromotor training. And then you really want to test some people, and you want to get them doing low reps. You want to, you know, for lifting for power, that's, you know, reps of 4 to 6. If we're lifting for explosiveness, maybe you're pushing it a little bit more. But, you know, you want to get comfortable making people a little bit uncomfortable. And then you want to be able to communicate with the team that, you know, okay, maybe I want you to go back and I want you to ski at 80% today. Or I want to cap your day out at 3 runs. I'm working with a lot of runners right now that are coming off of, you know, heavy, heavy seasons, 80, 90, 110 mile weeks. It's looking at the mileage and saying, you know, if you've got 1 or 2 really key races in the fall, you know, where do we periodize your training? Where do we back you off a little bit? And, you know, when do we let you go? You know, so it may be going out and actually running with somebody and teaching them, like, you know, this is the pace you need to be at to be successful in your sport.
Are you putting people in ski boots in the clinic? I mean, are you doing anything different? Because, I mean, essentially that's going to be their functional space, is in a set of ski boots or a set of snowboard boots. And do you kind of work towards that?
Yeah, we will put people in there in the clinic. And, you know, I'm fortunate, Skier's Edge is one of my sponsors. They've got a tremendous ski machine that you can actually, like, boot up and clip into. So, you know, it's not every patient that you do that with. And I certainly see a lot of, you know, bread and butter orthopedic patients. You know, with the high level folks, we will go ahead and, you know, we look at, you know, how do we get them back to their sport? How do we get as close to it as possible? A lot of these people are traveling. So, you know, last year at the ski injury roundtable, which the U.S. ski team puts on, you know, I did a presentation on, you know, appropriate neuromotor activation just using a kettlebell. So, you know, kettlebell is something that just about any team can throw in the van and travel with. How do you keep yourself fit when, you know, you're driving around and the green grocer's not there, and your local gym is not there, and you've got to kind of, you know, ad hoc on the road a little bit. So, you know, how do you bring things to a platform that, you know, traveling teams can succeed at?
Yeah, because they're going to be on the road a lot of the times, and they're not going to be with a regular trainer. They're not going to be on the hill unless it's for competition. So how do you keep that strength in between episodes? That's cool.
Right. And how do you keep them tuned in mentally as well, so that, you know, so that they know that they're really pushing their boundaries, and that, you know, they're keeping themselves ready for competition. And, you know, let's not forget, some of these athletes, if they're running a 5K, you know, they may be done in 15 minutes. You know, if a ski racer is hitting a slope style event, that might be a three minute deal. For some of these mogul skiers, you might be talking 45 seconds. You know, so you have to be ready kind of at all times to throw down, essentially.
But like you said, dropping 1% in terms of speed is going to be a big difference between making somebody stay where they are and jump into the next level.
Yeah, and it's cutthroat. I mean, you know, you've got sponsorships at stake, you've got college scholarships at stake, and, you know, the last thing you want to get in the back of an athlete's head is that, you know, my ride may be going away if I can't perform. You know, how do I get that to happen as well? So it's critical that we make sure that, you know, we're supporting them all the way around.
So have you been a clinical instructor before? Have you had some students in with you?
We, you know, I'm very fortunate. I'm the clinical manager here, and, you know, I believe strongly in students. So actually everyone takes a student once every 24 months. You know, we have generally at any time, we have between 2 and 3 students in the clinic. We've got a pretty decent size setup here. So we do tend to be pretty robust in terms of offerings. We have a DPT student right now from the University of Vermont who is doing phenomenal, who is kind of getting to absorb everything as well. You know, and it's a good experience.
You can tell me what their grade is, and we'll put this out, and we don't have to use their name or anything. No, that's going to be a pretty cool experience, especially if you're going to look to go to PT school in the University of Vermont. Obviously, you're most likely into skiing and snowboarding, so that's a pretty cool spot to be in.
Yeah, it is, and it's really neat because we've got a couple colleagues of mine that also test, shoes or they test running footwear, and you know, so at any given day in the clinic, you know, we may be unboxing. Right now we're looking at getting some new ski stuff in that we're kind of playing with. We're looking at testing shoes for the Gear Institute, and it's kind of nice because you're kind of on the forefront of sort of product development as well. So you get to kind of, you're a physical therapist, but you also get to expand and use your education a little bit more broader.
So why'd you get into dry needling? That's kind of like the hot topic now amongst PT students. What drew you to that? And
well, you know, I mean, it's interesting because I practice in a medical center. There's a lot of red tape, and there's also a lot of checks and balances in it. So I first got interested in dry needling probably around like 2011, and started kind of looking at it and saying, you know, what's the literature there? What's the emphasis? I'm a firm believer that you have to cultivate your practice. You know, I kind of got into talking to a few physical therapists that were also needling at the time. There was only one in the state that was doing it when I got initially started. So I actually traveled out of state to get some training and talk to some people. And beyond anything else, it was that you were getting in-session change that I wasn't seeing with other modalities or other treatments. I've been NDT trained, I'm trained Maitland therapist. I've done a bunch of technique stuff, everything from soft tissue mobilization. I've done a little ART training, and, people were just getting these gangbuster results with dry needling. You know, I said, you know, what's about it? What are they looking into? And I think it's a little unfair because, you know, people like to bash on dry needling and say that, you know, it's a placebo effect. It's invasive. I think the way that we're kind of looking at it is that we can draw a direct A to B correlation with anything. You can't eliminate the patient behavior in the intervention as well. So I think, you know, if you have patients that are, you know, they're kind of questioning it, they're excited to come into the clinic, it kind of is a motivator for them. You know, I think it's something that we have to look at. I will tell you that what's kind of kept me really stoked with dry needling is that it's a really small percentage of what I do, but it seems to draw in masses of people that would never, ever consider coming to a physical therapist are like coming out of the woodwork and saying, you know, hey, what is this about? I probably needle about 40% of the people who come to see me for needling. It's usually not right for them, or there's something else that's grossly wrong that we can address without doing the needling. But it pulls people into physical therapy. And, physical therapy's got a great construct. I believe that we are basically the people who use the physical realm to help, make people better and build better relationships with movement. When I do a session, most of my sessions are one-on-one with all my patients. They are generally 45 minutes plus. I might do 2 minutes of needling. And, you know, there's some good research out there by Vass and by Shaw that the needle does something. And most of our pain is multifactorial, got a lot of components to it. So if you change one or two things, you know, you may make the difference in somebody saying, yep, I'm going to do my home exercise program, or yes, I'm going to stick with the routine, or I want to have better adherence or compliance with the programming. The needling seems to, it pulls a lot of people in. There's a lot of intersession change. People feel dramatically better. I think some of it has to do with, you know, things we're not even talking about, like how are we changing the pH? How are we changing some of the circulation inside the tissue? And if you get somebody who's got like really chronic, you know, tissue dysfunction, or they've got headaches, and you know that manual therapy is really too much for them, the hands-on is too much, you can do a really nice kind of session with a little bit of moist heat. You drop a couple needles in, you do a little bit of winding, you can kind of get some turgor out of tissue, you can stretch it a little bit with needle manipulation, and then you get them into something active. You know, anything that gets people moving and exercising is really a win in my book.
I want to go back to something that you said just to make sure that, I mean, I heard it right, want to make sure that our listeners heard it right. You said you needle 40% of the people who come to you for needling.
And it's probably getting less.
Okay, I heard that this summer. I had a great CI and a great bunch of PTs around me, and some people who are detractors of the dry needling movement or practice of it would say, as soon as you start doing it, you start needling everybody. And it's good to see that there's PTs out there who are not just seeing the world for nails because you have a hammer. They're using it as a part of treatment. So that's really good to hear. And I've seen that from other PTs. But that's one thing that people who don't like dry needling or, you know, who are against it in PT practice, that's one thing they'll say is that you just start doing it and you're not doing actual PT after that.
Right. And one of the things that I think is really important for every physical therapist who needles or any technique for that matter, when I document, I actually document in minutes how much time I spend with the needling. So if you're looking at my note and you're going, wow, you know, they went and they saw Brian and he did needling. But wait a minute, he did 45 minutes of therapeutic exercise and he did, you know, another 15 minutes of manual hands-on work. And then he threw in 3 minutes of needling. It helps to build a better gestalt. And, you know, if somebody comes in and they've got something that's just grossly wrong with them, that the needling is not going to help or the area is too large, it's not in my best interest. It's not in the patient's best interest. You know, we really have to be good stewards of the profession and, you know, accurately represent what we can do. So I would say it's probably about 40%, probably maybe even less at this point.
So let's change topics real quick. What do you think the PT role in high altitude training, or if you think there's a role in that in terms of physiological training, is that a PT's realm?
Yeah, I think, you know, and I think it's a realm, you know, for any of the high altitude stuff. I think it's important because, you know, we make things really complicated. So, you know, you look at high altitude training and you say, it's VO2 max stuff and it's percentage of body fat. You know, you want to do a good physical exam on anybody and you want to kind of highlight what their blind spots are. You know, most people get really into training what works for them, but they neglect the blind spots. So if you can go ahead and you can draw somebody's attention to the fact that, you know, your hip doesn't go beyond your midline of your body. And every step you're fighting internal resistance when you're doing that. Or, you know, you've got a dorsiflexion restriction or, you know, you've got, you know, your right arm and your left arm are, you know, they're 40% difference in strength output. If you kind of look at, you know, what are the absolute misses and then what are the relative side to side symmetry, physical therapists, there's nobody better at doing that. I kind of knocked on us a little bit for the exercise piece. I think we're better in the assessment realm than we are for the exercise. But once you figure out what the limitations are, you know, go to town with hitting the exercise up, you know, cultivating your practice, you know, finding new ways to get people motivated and, you know, load them. I think it's really important to, you know, make sure that, you know, we're applying loads through the body that are going to be realistic and, you know, they're actually going to help them. You know, the person that goes to the gym and does reps of, you know, 30, they're just wasting their time.
So when you're bringing people in, you're saying, you know, we're really good at the assessment. What are you doing specifically? Are you doing SFMA? Are you doing some Maitland-driven evaluations for that kind of population? Or what's your approach?
So I do, you know, you kind of go back to Florence Kendall and kind of look at, you know, what the range of motion is, what the strength should be, you know, and do a good baseline assessment. I do like using SFMA. I've been trained a little bit of that with Kineticor. You know, I really appreciate the work those guys are putting out. You can kind of start from there. I also like some of the mobility workout of the day stuff is pretty good as well. I've been fortunate to work with some great guys like Bill Knowles and Tyler White, who are athletic trainers, but, you know, are just phenomenal with multi-planar off-axis exercise. And, you know, put people in challenging positions. You know, just have somebody, great starting point is, you know, have somebody stand on one foot and, you know, can they move the contralateral limb? You know, can they sit down on a Swiss ball and go off-axis? You don't have to make your exam all that complicated, but can they walk in a straight line with their eyes closed? You know, those are really good things that you can kind of look at. And can they do a full squat? If you clean up the ability for most people to do a full squat, good things happen. And it sounds like it's too good to be true, but if you look at the world we live in, we don't get out of that 90-90 chair posture enough. You know, we're kind of stuck in, you know, the lazy boy chair. And, you know, if you get people out and you draw them to the fact that, you know, hey, I don't know when we thought it was okay just to kind of relinquish, you know, shoulder flexion above 110 degrees. And can you do it with both arms? Because you may need to if you're climbing up the hill.
Right.
So, you know, put people into planks, have them do bear walks, you know, have them do side planks. I love doing, get into gladiator press position and then go crazy, go off axis, put a sandbag on their ankle, put a, you know, 10-pound kettlebell on their arm and see how far they can get before they tip over. You want to take people to a little bit of failure to kind of show them where we need to improve. And, you know, also just take a look at, do you have good motion and do you have good symmetry? If one of the shoulder blades is just totally winging out on you, you know, start there, start addressing that. Look at some of your packing positions, you know, and look at what somebody's capacity for load is. You know, that's a good way to kind of help program them.
That's a cool way to look at it. That's also something that we had heard on a previous episode with Eric Mera, just talking about a lot of times some PTs will get caught using 2-pound weights, even on an older population, when they walk in and their pocketbook or their purse is 10 pounds. And why are we giving them a 2-pound weight when I just watched them lift up 10 pounds? So that's good that you're really advocating to really push the athletes and push the patients and treat them like athletes.
Right. And, you know, everybody's an athlete. So, you know, if you look at somebody like, let's look at somebody who's running, and I'm not talking like running ultra marathons, but I'm talking, you got to run across the street so you don't get hit by a car. You got to put 2.5 to 3 times your body weight through each limb consecutively. You know, one of the return to sport things that I do with athletes or anybody is, you know, can they do some hopping? Start on a soft surface and, you know, just see what it looks like. If their posture totally falls apart or if they lose that mature weight shift, you know, then you got to back it down a little bit. But you're not loading anyone with a dowel. You know, if you give them a dowel and say, okay, I want you to do a squats, you're wasting your time. And more importantly, you're wasting your client's time. And people give up on exercise when they don't see results. We got to give them results. In running shape, I'm about 135 pounds. I'm pretty consistently snatching 70 to 80 pound kettlebells, because I want to be able to load the entire column and be able to progress with that and do something dynamically with that foot when it hits the ground. It's amazing when people come in and they see these kettlebells starting at, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 pounds, you know, and they say, I've never tried that. I've never been able to do that. And you say, sure you have. You've jumped. You know, you've jumped the last 2 steps of a curb, you know. You know, we have to stop kind of selling ourselves short with the exercise and really get better at how do we load people, how do we make it realistic, and then how do we make it, you know, reproducible so somebody can take it home and do it as a home program.
As a run of the runner, you would appreciate this. I was training for a race this summer and then all of a sudden had heel pain. I was gonna tough it out.
Yeah.
And one of our professors was like, well, just see if you can do this simple test. I was like, I'm going to do an Ironman this summer. I can do any test you throw at me. She said, hop on 1 foot for 2 minutes. I did it great on my right foot and then came the left. And I don't think I go for 30 seconds just because of pain. She said, you can't run. You can't run. I said, damn, she's right.
And you know, we take people all the time that, you know, maybe don't have the right prerequisites to do activities. And we run them until they break. And then when they break, they kind of wash out. And I mean, how many times does somebody come in and they said, well, you know, I used to do this, but I gave up. Well, why? Well, it hurts. Okay. Well, what'd you do about it? Absolutely nothing. And I went back to it in 6 months. Let's deconstruct some of the activities that we're doing and, you know, really look at, you know, what are the fundamentals of running? How much motion, if you want to swing an ice axe above your head, how much motion do you really need to swing an ice axe to get it to stick in the pitch to do something with it? If you want to pull yourself up with one arm, you know, you've got to be able to load that lat. And it's not about, you know, one person's, you know, nomenclature or another. It's just, you know, we got to be able to really induce load in people and make it functional. So get away from that yellow TheraBand and let's start making things happen.
I'm going to use that as the title of the episode, by the way. Get away from the yellow TheraBand.
Taking IPAs over TKAs. It's the PT Pinecast. The PT Pinecast proudly supports the Wounded Warrior Project. Since 2003, the Wounded Warrior Project has been raising funds and awareness for the needs of injured service members, helping injured servicemen and women with aid and assistance, and to provide unique direct programs and services to meet their needs. Their continuing goal is to foster the most successful, well-adjusted generation of wounded service members in our nation's history. To find out how you can help the Wounded Warrior Project, visit them online at woundedwarriorproject.org. Like what you hear? Leave us a review on iTunes. It's not like our moms can keep giving us 5 stars every day. Or can they?
All right, very, very controversial and tough question coming right now. You have 2 choices. 1 east of the Mississippi, 1 west of the Mississippi. Favorite ski hills, go.
East of the Mississippi, my favorite hill is Mad River Glen, because it is vicious. It will, you know, spit you out and chew you up. Gets very little man-made snow love, but it has a diehard crowd, and you know, they drink more Magic Cat beer than I think anybody.
Ski it if you can.
Ski it if you can. And then west, I'm a big fan of Big Sky Montana. I've been out there a number of times. I've competed out there. You know, I've also free skied out there, and you know, I love getting out in the you know, in the shoots and kind of testing the limits with the gear and yourself and, you know, just, you know, pushing yourself beyond what you think you can accomplish.
All right. I'm going to take those to heart, and maybe this winter I can get to one of those too. What does another generation of PT student need to know, either just as we're leaving PT school, the new grads who just graduated and passed the boards, or the students who are just starting? What's a clinical pearl of wisdom from Brian Finch?
I'll draw a parallel to skiing. So I was up in Toronto maybe about 9 months ago. I was there for a ski show in the fall, and, you know, we were kind of meeting people and whatnot, and there were a bunch of pros, and we were talking about technique, right? And somebody said to me, well, you know, the way that you start a turn in Canada is this. And they proceeded to list out a series of things that biomechanically happen. And I said, well, how is that different from the way that a ski turn starts, you know, 70 miles south of here? And they said, oh, well, you know, the Americans have a different way of describing it. So here's the pearl of wisdom, if I can leave you with nothing else. By the time you get to a system or a course or a way of looking at the body, the people have had to invest time in, they've had to develop it. I think at the heart of every system, somebody has looked at the way we were doing something and said, man, that's not right. And they've tried to do it a little bit better. But by the time it gets brought to market, you've got trademark terms and you've got nomenclature, you've got texts that are printed. I've actually been to courses where they said, we know that the textbook is garbage, but, you know, we bought 10,000 of them. And kind of shake your head. And so, you know, the way that you ski in Canada is just like the way that you ski in America or the United States. And the way that most people treat is actually very similar. So if you go and you go to a Maitland course, or if you go to a dry needling course, or you do SFMA, you know, even if you go to like John Barnes, if you go to anybody who's putting something on now, don't look at the differences. Look at how things are similar, because what you're going to find is peel things away. You know, somebody needed to support what they were driving. You don't get to host courses for free. They needed to, you know, get the money to have the books and sell the systems, and rightfully so. And they deserve the credit. And at the heart of things, what they said was, I think I can help advance the practice. So right now, it seems like we spend a lot of time tearing people apart for, you know, this system isn't perfect or that system isn't perfect. I got to tell you, one of the best things I ever did was to get NDT trained. And because it teaches you that, you know, movement is either pure or it's aberrant. You know, that's really what most of these systems are doing. They just do it in a little bit different tweaks. If you look at somebody who's teaching ART and you look at somebody who's teaching facilitated oscillated release, they're really doing very similar things. But for trademark reasons and for teaching reasons, they have, they've got to call them something different. I would challenge your professors and your CIs. What are the things that are really the same in everything that we're doing? Is muscle energy really nothing different than, you know, applied biomechanics and something called BRIME, which is brief repetitive isometric exercise, which has been around forever, you know, since the 70s. And are some of oscillations and the manipulation techniques, you know, they're really not that different. We put different spins on them.
Because you're such in such a specific field with all the skiers and the snowboarders and the alpine athletes that you're seeing, what are your thoughts on students reaching out to try to get one of their affiliations with you versus just kind of letting the system work for them and hoping to eventually get into something like that after school?
You know, I mean, I would take a much more active role in it. If you reach out to somebody, and most of us, you know, we love to teach. It's kind of funny. I don't have a student right now, but I feel like I'm hogging the student all the time. So if you reach out to somebody, if they're really invested in it, they will fight and spend the time to make sure you get in the clinic. You know, we always welcome people to come on up and observe, see what's going on. It also teaches students that, you know, not everything is glamorous. You know, there are some bread and butter things that we all kind of have to do, you know, just as a basic clinician. You know, you can help just about everybody on some level. But I would definitely tell you, if there's somebody that you're following on Instagram or Twitter and you're like, I relate to them and I see what they're doing, call them up, you know, call them up and, hey, can I spend an afternoon in your clinic? Can I come see what you're doing? Can I see you with some of the athletes? Can I take a few runs with you on the hill? We do that with students all the time. They may just come ski with us. And, you know, they kind of see I do a lot of ski testing. And so, you know, it might just be interesting for them just to see what that's all about and to kind of see how that progression works. But if you reach out to somebody, I bet you'll be pleasantly surprised. You know, it's not to say you won't get paired up well, but, you know, you really have to, if you expect something to happen, go after it and get it.
I like
that's what I would say.
I'm going to be checking weather.com, and once we see some nice dusting over in Vermont, my roommate and I will hit the car and we'll come on up and say hi. So, I appreciate that, man. Well, hey, this is the first time we've done a PT Pinecast episode where the guy I'm talking to is outside in the hills, man. Yeah, I like that.
What other tough questions do you have for me? What else can I say controversial?
I'm not really looking for controversy. I mean, if I find it, great. I know there's areas that are more controversial than other. Like right now, for some reason, the dry needling thing is a hot topic. And for myself, I was exposed to it. I had it done to me for an injury. I had positive results. So yeah. I'm on the camp that's like, well, I think this is a useful tool.
Yeah.
I do agree with some of the people who say are against it in terms of you can't just overuse it. But I think that's with anything. You can't overuse anything.
So if there's one thing that I would give a student advice on, not just relative to a specific technique, and I think about every patient this way, you know, basically, you know, we want to build better relationships with movement. That's our goal. You know, if you look at how movement occurs, it's basically, it comes from, you know, four tracks, right? And you've got four basic centers where movement is happening or you're developing tone. You've got the reticular activating system, you've got the limbics, you've got the cerebellum, and you've got the cortical spinal tract, okay? So if you think about it, movement is really the interplay of, you know, what's your arousal level like, what's your memories and what's your feelings like, you know, how are you able to coordinate it, and then, you know, what can you do volitionally? You know, the reason I bring that up is it's really easy to be a student or even a seasoned therapist and to look at somebody and say, you know what, you know, they're not doing good therapy. Because the way I would treat that person is X, Y, and Z. I'll draw you to a really simple example. So the person who comes in and let's say they've never been to physical therapy before, they're a blank slate, rolled their ankle. I may look at them and say, you know, what do I have that I can help them with training their ankle better? And, you know, if they're telling me that, you know, hey, I'm a runner and I want to get back to this, you know, we may do some, stuff on the treadmill. I may put them on the, you know, like the gravity minimized treadmill. I may get them running first day. I may do that, and they may only have 20 pounds on that limb. If you get somebody who, let's say that they're a little bit older, and they've been to physical therapy a number of times, and their frame of reference is that, you know, physical therapy is something that happens on the mat. You know, they go in and they lay down on the plinth, and they get some joint mobs done to them. Maybe they get some stretching. They get a lot of, basic exercises on the plinth. Don't look at one as being better than the other. Look at how you're treating the person and what they're bringing to the table, because the athlete might have a frame of reference where, you know, for me to optimize my return, I need to be in upright. I need to be doing something that I'm perceiving as athletic. I need to be in the right arousal state. And I might need to, you know, I might need to feel like I'm getting back to my sport. The person who maybe has been to therapy five or six times before and is used, you know, maybe they're just used to some hands-on treatment. Maybe they're used to, being treated on the plinth a little bit more. That might be what is healing for them. So I think it's a little disconcerting when I hear on Twitter, you know, this is good therapy, this is bad therapy. You really have to consider, you know, what's your volitional take on it? What's your motivation? What's your memory of it? What's your arousal? And, you know, how are you able to coordinate it? Take what the person is bringing you and work with it instead of you trying to impose your style on everyone else. I graduated in the 90s. Everything was functional. So, you know, we threw everybody on three layers of foam, a Bosu ball, and a rocker board. And I got to tell you, if I came at somebody like that now, they would, if they weren't from that sort of frame of reference, they would go home and post that, you know, this guy's a complete quack, man. He came at me with 10 layers of foam and told me I needed to scratch my ear while I was doing a split squat. You know, so you gotta consider what the frame of reference of your patient is, because we're really not here for us. We're here for them.
I like that as a student hearing that, because just finishing my clinical rotation this past summer, I was so nervous about not doing the right thing. And I was just assuming that as soon as I saw the patient, we did the eval, I got past that. Now it's time for treatment. I was like, man, I better pick the right thing. And I kept thinking there was one. And eventually throughout the 12 weeks, I started to realize I might just like to have him up and I might do stuff off the mat, whereas my CI might not. And to hear that from you and hear that from other people, especially my CI, there's no one right way to make them better. So like you said, there's no good or bad, there's just different.
No, and I truly believe, and you can apply this to dry needling or exercise. The only rule with exercise is make sure you load them. It's the only thing I can tell you. Make sure that you load them. And if you don't think you're loading them, load them somewhere else. You know, but our presentations are so multifactorial that if you change one aspect of it, you're going to change the whole presentation. So the intervention that breaks the cycle is the right intervention. You can probably find five or six of those that work off the bat. But, you know, really trying, you know, in your eval, take the time, do less talking than your patient, and let them guide you towards what they need. They will tell you what their body needs. And then, you know, even if you're the person that hates treating on the plinth, you may have to do it because that's what the patient needs. you know, and that may be their frame of reference. And if I bring somebody up and say, you know, sometimes we have skis in the clinic or we have equipment in the clinic, you know, if I bring somebody over and say, you know, oh, I'm going to put you on a pair of skis and you're just going to stand on it and get your balance going back and forth and teetering, you know, that may freak them out. That may put them back 2 weeks. Whereas if I say, look, you know, this is just like doing a sit to stand, like you're getting off the commode, that may be everything they need to really, you know, make a meaningful impact and to kind of hardwire some of those changes. It's not about us.
That's a good point. I kind of like that quote right there. It isn't about us. And you're saying do less talking so you can do a little more listening, because that's the point. And that, from what I was taught in my very first year of PT school, that's one of the things that separates PTs from other healthcare practitioners, is just the straight up amount of time that we get to spend face to face with our patients.
We're so gifted and, you know, we get to spend all this time with the patient. And so just make the most of it, and be a sponge, learn as much as you can and let them guide you to where they need to be. Don't be afraid to help them course correct, but, you know, as long as you're giving them things that are moving them in the right direction, there's no wrong therapy. So,
good words of advice from Brian Finch. Well, I appreciate it. Brian Finch, PTCSCS. You can find him online, Twitter, at Alpine Athlete, working out in Vermont at the Rutland Regional Medical Center and taking some time out from his busy schedule with skiers and snowboarders and climbers to talk to us on the PT Pinecast. Brian, it's been a pleasure. And don't be surprised if there's a knock on the door and there's a couple PT students outside with some skis looking to do some skiing with you.
We welcome it. So thank you very much for the time.
Appreciate it, man.
Follow us on Twitter at PT Pinecast and online at ptpintcast.com. It's like TMZ, except with way more important information. And no Miley Cyrus. Okay, it's not like TMZ at all. The PT Pinecast is intended for educational purposes only. No clinical decision-making should be based solely on one source. While care is taken to ensure accuracy, factual errors can be present. Our lawyers made us read that.